Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
You're listening to Chicago's Afternoon News here on 720 WGN. President Biden unveiled his long-awaited infrastructure plan. So what's in it and what might change in the future? We're going to get some answers from David Basanko. He is the IBM Professor of Regulation and Competitive Practices at the Kellogg School of Management. David, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, so when we heard about the, it was a joke in the last administration. Every time things got tough, it was going to be, people started laughing that it was infrastructure week. President Trump might have done really well by himself had he started with infrastructure, because generally It tends to be bipartisan. He did not. Biden is not really starting with it, but he's going to it early. But when I think of infrastructure bills, I think of roads and bridges, airports, things like that. What the president is proposing seems to go well beyond that.
It does. It's both a serious infrastructure bill, but it's also a serious proposal for more public investment across a variety of policy areas. I sort of group what he is proposing into six categories. So there's sort of traditional transportation and public works infrastructure. That's roughly a quarter of the $2.2 trillion proposal. There's infrastructure that's designed to serve as a platform for a low-carbon economy. There's social infrastructure, which is like public schools, veterans hospitals, community colleges, federal buildings. The fourth bucket is about revitalization of left-behind places, so that's high-speed broadband, and there's a new rural partnership program that's being proposed. Then there's a fifth category that has a whole bunch of investments in public goods, what we economists call public goods, as well as economic development. And then there's sort of a last category, which is just a number of sort of key social priorities, most especially housing and retraining and in-home care. So all told, you know, the kind of the traditional infrastructure portion of this would be, you know, sort of about half of it in terms of overall funding. But much of the rest of it is I think, pretty important stuff as well.
Well, talk to me about the influence or the climate sort of change part of this. And you talk about electric vehicles and things, how that investment now could really be a game changer for the future. Explain that for me.
Well, you know, about $174 billion is being targeted for either electric vehicle incentives like tax credits or the building out of electric vehicle charging stations. They have in mind, I think, something like 400,000 electric vehicle charging stations. And Steve, just to put that in perspective, right now in the U.S., there are roughly 115,000 gasoline stations.
Wow.
So this is a very significant build out of charging stations. And I think this is really an appropriate role for the federal government to take on, because what essentially we have right now with electric vehicles is kind of a chicken and egg problem. You know, you're reluctant perhaps to buy an electric vehicle because you're worried that you can only go maybe 200 miles on a charge. And, any sort of between city travel, you know, that could leave you stranded.
Right.
And well, so, to be confident in buying an electric vehicle for sort of normal uses, you'd have to be confident that there are a whole bunch of charging stations that you could tap into if necessary. But who's going to provide the charging stations? I mean, that's a major investment. Private firms might provide them if they were confident that there was the demand for electric vehicles, but the demand for electric vehicles may not be forthcoming until there's confidence that there are enough charging stations. So this is kind of a case where you need the government to kind of step in and solve a coordination problem that would be hard to solve through the private market.
You know, years ago, I talked about a trucking company. I think it was a dairy, and they were running. They converted methane into natural gas to ship or to fuel their dairy trucks. But one of the first things they had to do was literally every few hundred miles build another filling station for their particular gas because it didn't exist in the private market.
Right, right. This is the same problem writ large. If we really want to electrify our transportation infrastructure, you know, the most significant part of that is going to be electric vehicles, either electric cars or electric powered trucks. And, you know, you need to solve that chicken or egg problem in order to be able to do that.
How about climate change and the impact there when it comes to, do we need to spend money to repair things damaged by climate change? Is he planning to prepare for future climate change, or what exactly is that part of the, tell me about that bucket.
Yeah, so there's a bit of both there. There's a significant chunk of money, about $100 billion, which is aimed at developing either incentives for clean energy like wind or solar. We already have those kind of incentives, but the way Congress has traditionally worked is that they make them short term, so they expire every year or so. And so what this proposal is suggesting is to actually, you know, create a 10-year window for tax incentives, tax credits for the building of wind power or solar power facilities. So that's part of it. Another part of it is to invest in long-distance transmission lines, which is actually pretty important, too, if you want to have a greater share of the grid being represented by renewable energy like wind and solar. Those are places typically, I mean, where the wind farms are, where the solar facilities are oftentimes far away from where the electricity is demanded, so you need to have long-distance transmission lines. So this proposal calls for investment in that. And you also just need to have a more resilient grid. You know, you need to have backup, the capability to provide backup electricity during those times when wind is unavailable or when the sun isn't shining. And so this proposal is going to do that as well. It's going to build out transmission infrastructure for that.
I happen to be reading Barack Obama's memoir, and I'm at the point about the deep water spill in the Gulf of Mexico in that disaster. Mm-hmm. It's coincidental, but Biden would sort of phase out a lot of fossil fuel subsidies to try to move us away from that?
Yeah, their objective is carbon-free electricity by 2035, which is a pretty ambitious objective. And I think experts still disagree as to whether actually that's going to be feasible, you know, because the thing about fossil powered electricity like natural gas or coal, and of course, coal is actually going away pretty rapidly right now. But natural gas is probably going to need to stay around for a while, if only to provide, you know, for peak load capacity and to provide backup in those times when wind or solar power isn't available on demand because the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. So that's an ambitious objective. It may require some continued role or maybe even a somewhat expanded role for nuclear power. This proposal actually does call for some investment in research around kind of advanced technologies like advanced nuclear and hydrogen. But, you know, it is an ambitious objective to essentially decarbonize the electricity grid in roughly 15 years.
Well, the Republicans right away are looking at the cost of it. And, you know, we've talked about how this is it expands really the definition of infrastructure. You bring up a couple of ideas that have been out there and have happened elsewhere in the world, but a congestion pricing sort of tax. Are you talking about for people who drive into the inner city, or what do you mean by that?
Well, so my view about the financing of this is that the ideal method of financing would be fairly broad based, because both traditional infrastructure as well as the, you know, social infrastructure and these investments in public goods, you know, have broad ranging benefits to society. I mean, businesses benefit, consumers in our role as shoppers benefit. Households in their role as suppliers of labor benefit, and so the benefits are really pretty widespread. And I think, you know, to match that, you want to have a fairly broad base of funding, which, you know, I think, you know, could include increasing corporate taxes, which is the main way in which the Biden administration proposes to pay for this plan. Perhaps also some modest increases in personal income taxes. I think, you know, sort of traditional funding mechanisms like the gasoline tax probably ought to be on the table. That's unpopular, but it's a very efficient tax, actually, it turns out. And congestion pricing, which is also actually a fairly efficient tax, may have a small role to play. I don't want to suggest that congestion pricing would bear the burden of, you know, raising $2.2 trillion.
Right, no.
That wouldn't be possible at all. But you know, selectively in some parts of the country, you know, in a Chicago, in a New York, you know, in a Los Angeles or San Francisco, where traffic congestion is a serious problem, and where we each as commuters impose congestion costs on our fellow commuters, I think congestion pricing has a role to play, both for funding part of this, but also for perhaps forcing us into making better choices in terms of how we get from point A to point B. Do we really need to, you know, travel down the Edens Expressway, you know, at 8 a.m. To get downtown when we have other options like Metra or the L?
David Basenko is an IBM professor of regulation competitive practices at Northwestern. Okay, congestion pricing, I got that. You talked about the gas tax, but the fact is Biden is moving us all toward electric vehicles. They don't use gas, and there's been talk, I think in Oregon they've been doing it for a long time. You tell me, about taxing the miles we drive rather than what we put in our car to drive them.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. I mean, Oregon has had a vehicle mileage tax, I think, for a number of years. They started experimenting with it about 10 years ago, in fact. And I think a vehicle mileage tax, again, is something to look at, and I think makes sense because there are some, you know, kind of spillovers that drivers impose on one another, increased accident risk, for example, that really are a function of how many miles we drive. And so, you know, to kind of internalize that spillover, it makes sense, I think, to tax miles traveled. So I think that could be part of it. The gasoline tax is interesting. It is true that as vehicles, fuel economy gets better and better, and of course the Biden administration is going to be proposing, you know, more aggressive increases in fuel economy. And as we go to more of an electrified stock of vehicles, the gasoline tax will become less effective as a revenue generator. But I think we're still a ways away from that. In other words, you know, the kind of changes that I just mentioned are changes that occur on the margins. They affect the flow of new vehicles, but there's still a large stock of existing internal combustion engine vehicles that get, you know, kind of mediocre fuel economy on average, from which the gasoline tax actually can still raise a lot of revenue. So I think the gasoline tax still has a role to play, at least over the next couple of decades. And, you know, one indication of that is that over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, a number of states have actually raised their gasoline tax rates. So at the state level, that tax is still playing a pretty important role.
Professor David Basenko from Northwestern University. We started with the sweet, ended a little bit there with the sour. Professor, it was nice to talk to you. I appreciate it.
Very nice to talk to you, Steve. Thank you so much.
We're going to head into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. After that, it is Transgender Visibility Day. That's coming up on Chicago's Afternoon News.